The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It's inescapable to me, the idea that anti-Semitism is in the air. And of course, young people and mentally ill people will pick up on what they're hearing. And I would say, to me, the most compelling argument for why we're seeing this uptick is that we are living in a very conspiratorial time. The president is a conspiracy theorist. He has trafficked in anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that we know motivated the Pittsburgh and Poway attackers, because they quoted those same conspiracy theories about George Soros paying for migrants to come to the United States. And what the left has done is, in many ways, it often accepts the terms that Trump lays out, and sort of, they fight him kind of on his own turf. And so in response to his conspiracy theories, they have their own conspiracy theories.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 18th, 2020. Batya Ungar Sargon is the opinion editor of The Forward, the Jewish newspaper published out of New York City. She has been among the chroniclers, both in print and on Twitter, of the recent spate of attacks against Orthodox communities in New York and New Jersey. She is one of the most thoughtful analysts of anti-Semitism in life and in public discourse that I know. And I have admired her work on Twitter on the subject for quite some time, as well as her writing. She joined me today from New York by Skype, and we talked about where these attacks are coming from, why they are so hard to respond to, and why they don't fit in with any of our political preconceptions. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 497. Batya Ungar Sargon on the anti-Semitic violence in New York. Batya, I want to start with just an overview from your perspective of the violence that's taken place over the last several months in the tri-state area, and to the extent that it has not been limited to there elsewhere. How, in as sort of neutral and factual a way as you can, how would you describe this spate of attacks against Jews?
I would say that I started noticing it about a year and a half ago. You would see a video on social media of somebody attacking a visibly Jewish person, mostly in New York, actually, in New York neighborhoods that are very heavily populated by Orthodox Jews and minority communities. And, you know, you would see it, you know, once a month, maybe there would be some video and it was very shocking and sort of like, gosh, that's terrible. And then you would kind of forget about it because we were sort of dealing with Pittsburgh and Poway, right? There was this sense that white nationalism was on the rise, which it is, and that there were these attacks coming from the white nationalist right against Jews in their places of worship. So you had 11 Jews murdered at prayer in Pittsburgh, and then one Jew murdered in Poway. And over the last 6 months, the frequency of these attacks against visibly Jewish people in the tri-state area have just skyrocketed. So we knew that there was rising anti-Semitism, rising anti-Semitic vandalism. But what the ADL has found recently is that not only is anti-Semitism on the rise, but it's getting increasingly violent. And the truth is, this violence really is, by and large, if not exclusively, targeting visibly Jewish people after Poway, since April of 2019, it's really been pretty much exclusively targeting Orthodox Jewish people. So we've had a lot of sort of physical attacks, assaults, so people getting punched, people having their yarmulkes or their shapels, their wigs pulled off, people being slapped, people being attacked with bricks, and then all the way up until what happened in Jersey City, where two Jews were murdered in a supermarket, as well as a police officer and an employee at the supermarket. And then the machete attack in Muncie, where five people were stabbed, and one person is still in a coma from that. So really all culminated in, you know, over Hanukkah, which is, you know, the holiday of light, there were 11 attacks during that 8-day period, which was sort of the apex.
So I want to sort of disaggregate for a moment the nature of the attacks. You described how we were all focused on white nationalist, white supremacist violence, and so we kind of didn't notice initially this spate of attacks. To what extent is there, these are not white supremacist attacks, to what extent is there a common vector, or, you know, can we say that there is a sort of ideological thread to any of this?
It's a great question. We can't answer it for certain because the NYPD has refused to release the information from the last quarter of last year. And so what we are doing right now is really going based on lists that have been compiled by journalists because the NYPD won't give us the information. So let me tell you what the journalists have found, and then I'll tell you, you know, the way I see the question of ideology here. So Laura Adkins at JTA has been keeping a running list, and what she says, you know, from the last 6 months or so, that there have been anywhere from 60 to 90 physical attacks against Orthodox Jews in the New York area, really, and that 80% of them have been committed by African Americans. Now, that is just a list from what she's able to compile from what she has seen shared by people in the community and the Jewish press. The NYPD won't release their data. And we, you know, at the Forward have filed multiple Freedom of Information Act requests, and we've been turned down. We do know something about the data because somebody who has reviewed it wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. And he wrote that 1/3 of the attacks have been committed by people who are mentally ill, and 2/3 have been committed by young African-American men who live in these neighborhoods. So what we know from this is actually, it's interesting because the NYPD did release information from earlier in the year where they said that only 33% of the arrests were African-American men, of arrests of people who had committed anti-Semitic acts over the last year. So we know that there's also a problem here of not arresting the people who are committing these attacks. So, and I think you can really see, for example, Grafton Thomas, the man who committed the machete attack. I mean, he's so clearly mentally ill. Like, it's very clear from images that have come across and things that his family members have said about him. So, you know, to me, a mentally ill person, like a young man, these are not ideological people. Mentally ill people don't have access to it. They're not ideological. I think it's wrong to say that these are ideologically motivated. However, it's inescapable to me the idea that anti-Semitism is in the air. And of course, young people and mentally ill people will pick up on what they're hearing. And I would say, to me, the most compelling argument for why we're seeing this uptick is that we are living in a very conspiratorial time. The president is a conspiracy theorist. He has trafficked in anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that we know motivated the Pittsburgh and Poway attackers because they quoted those same conspiracy theories about George Soros paying for migrants to come to the United States. And what the left has done is, in many ways, it often accepts the terms that Trump lays out and sort of they fight him kind of on his own turf. And so in response to his conspiracy theories, they have their own conspiracy theories. And of course, anti-Semitism is a conspiracy theory about Jewish power, one that I think is often invisible to the left because Jews do have power and the left is all about speaking truth to power. And so, you know, speaking negatively to or about Jews often appears like, you know, it has the grammar of social justice. So there's sometimes conflation and confusion there. So I wouldn't say that these attacks are motivated by leftist ideology. What I would say is that the silence around them from lefty leaders in New York, I think, has very much enabled them to continue. And the discomfort with saying, with noticing and speaking out against Black people attacking Jews, I think has enabled it to continue. Now, of course, it's not the Black community in its entirety attacking the Jewish community. It's people from the margins of society, you know, disaffected youth and people who are mentally ill. But the fact that there hasn't been a robust response to this, I think, has very much enabled it. I will say one more thing, which is that, you know, to me, it's always been clear that this is not motivated by leftist ideology. It's definitely not motivated by rightist ideology, right? You know, Black people are not white supremacists. But it, what's been really interesting has been seeing the far left, as well as now the National Review, putting out articles in which they argue that this is happening because of things like gentrification. And that's so funny, because in a way that is supplying a leftist ideology, which I don't think is there. But yeah, I think these are mostly non-ideological attacks that stem from, you know, people from the margins of society picking up on a feeling of that Orthodox Jews are nobody's problem. And so you can sort of freely attack them and no one will come to rescue them or stand up for them, which has indeed been the case. No one has stood up for them or come to rescue them.
All right. So there's a huge amount in there, and I want to unpack it piece by piece. So one thing that you're saying is that the right-wing white nationalist conspiracy theorizing and the related conspiracy theorizing by the president and forces loyal to the president is in an odd way in dialogue with wholly unrelated streams of the political culture in ways that produce violence. Is that a fair distillation of that aspect of what you're saying?
I mean, yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think that Trump he's clearly transformed the right. That's very clear, the ways in which he's transformed the Republican Party, making it sort of into a populist party that has, you know, sometimes racist tendencies, but also a socialist, protectionist, economic aspect to it. So he's very clearly transformed the right, but I think he's also very much transformed the left, that often will respond to him very much in kind, of course, not using the same racist language that he uses, but very much in the same vein of like almost hysterical opposition, where instead of saying, you know, well, we don't accept, you know, what you're saying or the terms that you're using, they kind of accept the terms and then just reverse them in many ways. You'll see this like around immigration. So instead of saying, you know, President Trump, the way you're talking about immigrants is vile and harmful to Latino communities, no one should speak that way. Obviously, the vast majority of Americans want some sort of reasonable immigration policy. Let's think about how to be reasonable about it. They kind of accept his terms that, like, you know, that there's this inherent relationship between immigration and racism. And they say, okay, we have to have open borders so that we're not racist, right? And I think that you see that a lot with Israel, for example. Like, he talks about Israel in this way that's very extreme and very alienating to a lot of people. And so instead of, you know, saying, no, here is the reasonable position, the left will be like, no, I am BDS, right? Like, so you'll see like that. And I think that that's sort of happening very much in the discourse around Jews as well.
But if you're a young Black man who's mentally ill in one of these communities in New York, and you've been around Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox people your whole life, and there's been a certain amount of gentrification going on for the last several years, you were not thinking, you know, to the extent that you're mentally ill and have violent tendencies, you were not attacking Orthodox Jews 3 years ago. But today, you know, in an environment in which Pittsburgh happens and Poway happens, and the president talks about, you know, runs ads about George Soros, and there is a dialogue of anti-Semitism on, you know, on both left and right, and we'll talk about those different strains momentarily. That ambient environment does seem to be affecting the way people who are not part of those political movements behave toward Jews in their local communities, right?
I think I think it's a little more complicated than that. And here I'm a little bit outside the mainstream. I think what you just said is something that many, many people would think is true. To me, the violence against the Orthodox is a little bit different than Pittsburgh and Poway, because it does seem to me that, regrettably, a lot of liberal and secular Jews have participated in the kind of otherizing of Orthodox Jews, not on purpose, God forbid, but, you know, it's undeniable that there is kind of tension within the community between sort of the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox. So I think that it's a little bit more complex than that. I think the way that I think about it is, a young mentally ill man in one of these neighborhoods has gotten the message that Orthodox Jews are, I call it hefker. It's a Talmudic term that means unclaimed, that they're nobody's responsibility. And I think it's hard to directly tie that to Trump, because he is surrounded by Orthodox Jews. You know, he clearly has a good relationship with the Orthodox Jewish community. So I think that it really is more about what they're picking up from within their, you know, the communities. And again, I don't think that there's anti-Semitism, you know, diffusing these communities, but rather that there is a sense that from elected officials and from leaders that, you know, nobody's gonna, if you let off steam by attacking an Orthodox person, there's a good chance you'll get away with it. I mean, that I think is the feeling that is seems to me to be reigning and enabling this. And the reason nobody is going to speak up for these people does kind of retroactively come back to Trump, because it is about how the left has reformed itself in response to him. Does that make sense?
Yes, very much so. So let's talk about the different strains of anti-Semitism that are, we've alluded to this in over the last few minutes, but let's tease it out. One of the things, and for those listeners who don't follow Batya on Twitter, one of the things that is very admirable about your approach to these issues is that you are very consistent about not weaponizing anti-Semitism on behalf of your own political views, or engaging in this debate over whether the bigger problem is left anti-Semitism or right anti-Semitism, or, you know, you take a very call it out on a consistent basis, irrespective of the politics of the person, approach to it. That all said, left anti-Semitism and right anti-Semitism are different in some ways and partake of similar themes in other ways. And so, you know, walk us through the typologies of anti-Semitism in the current American political landscape. What does it look like on the right? What does it look like in the center? What does it look like on the left?
That's such a good question. You know, in some ways, I kind of almost resist it, because anti-Semitism is so much older than the right-left divide. It's truly a grammar that people slide into almost unconsciously, and it doesn't really matter what side you're on. So I want to throw that out there, that there is a way in which this really does predate the categories that we have for our current political moment.
I'm so glad you said that, because it's not just right, it's really importantly right, that this is a very deep thing that people engage in without having any idea that they're engaging in a lot of the time. And that said, and I like your use of the word grammar there. That said, when people speak with this grammar from the right, they sound different than when they speak with this grammar from the, there's a left inflection, if we're going to stick with linguistic metaphors, there's a left accent for it and there's a right accent for it, right? So let me ask the question a little differently. When the right speaks with the grammar of anti-Semitism, what does it sound like, and how does it sound different from when the left speaks through the grammar of anti-Semitism?
I'm gonna answer your question, then I'm gonna push back again, because you're not wrong. I mean, of course, like because the right and the left have different commitments. When they blame Jews for their problems, it sounds differently. But then there are some interesting crossovers as well. So I'll start with the differences. So you're not going to have somebody on the left complaining about the great replacement theory. Okay, so what's that? So when white supremacists marched in Charlottesville, they were walking with tiki torches and chanting, "Jews will not replace us." And I remember I was so confused, like, replace you where?
Yeah, I always wanted, whenever one of those people got arrested, to tweet a picture of his face crossed out and just replaced by a Jew.
Right, exactly. Like, we're not, you know, like, we're not like moving en masse into, you know, Appalachia or whatever. But what they mean is it was a reference to the Great Replacement Theory, which is an anti-Semitic canard that believes that Jews are trying to replace the white race with people of color through helping them with immigration and helping refugees come here. That Jews are sort of, you know, the enemy of the white man, and we want to rule. So, but we know that we can't beat the white people, so we do it. This is like the theory, which is anti-Semitic and racist, right? So what we do is we bring people of color in to replace white people, and then we rule over them. Like, that's the conspiracy theory. So of course you're not going to hear it's racist. So you're not going to hear like somebody who cares about racism against people of color spouting this theory. So that's an example of something you hear on the right. And often they'll use George Soros as a stand-in. Oh, George Soros is paying for this, you know, for this migrant caravan. So of course you can criticize George Soros. It's not inherently anti-Semitic to criticize George Soros, but when you plug in the name George Soros into a sentence whose grammar is anti-Semitic, right, that there are people who are paying to replace white people with people of color, then it becomes anti-Semitic. So that's the kind of thing that you would hear on the right, the idea that Jews are secretly undermining the white ethno state of America. The things that you would hear on the left are things like, that, you know, Hasidim are, they own all the property, that they are gentrifying these neighborhoods, right? Not themselves, but that they are bringing in white people to make, you know, people of color's neighborhoods worse, right? And that they, or that they are using up all of the, you know, the limited resource of welfare, that they are secretly organized to use up these resources, that they are kind of taking more than their fair share, that these Jews are making things worse for people of color. And you see that a lot in the, like, Zionism is racism, right? Like, you take Jewish sovereignty, that's the concept of Jewish national sovereignty, it's inherently racist, right? Like, you can't be a Jew who desires self-determination without harming people of color. So that's sort of, those are sort of two ways in which it manifests. However, there's so much crossover. So for example, in the Poway shooter, he wrote a manifesto, and in his manifesto, he complained about Jews replacing the white people, whatever. And then he also said, oh, and by the way, they controlled the slave trade as well. Now, that canard, that Jews controlled the slave trade, that's you see that a lot on the right in 4chan and in these places where there are a lot of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, but that came straight from the left, right? That was, you know, Leonard Jeffries, and he was a professor at CUNY, right? And he was writing about Jews controlling the slave trade, and that went, you know, filtered down through Louis Farrakhan, who's not a leftist, but who it filtered through him to Tamika Mallory and the leaders of the Women's March, who were quoted, you know, the New York Times reported that they had said that as well, that Jews controlled the slave trade. So in a way, you know, you see these things, like, they really cross-pollinate. You know, David Duke, for example, loves Ilhan Omar because of what she said about AIPAC. David Duke, he speaks about Israel and Zionism in the exact same terms that a lot of people on the far left do. So to a certain extent, I really feel that I'm not sure it matters so much to be talking about left versus right. We do it because naturally, instinctively, that's how we break up our political moment. But anti-Semitism, I do feel, is a little bit deeper and older than that. And you'll always find people on either side saying the same thing.
And yet there is this fierce debate going on now that I confess really shocks me, about whether the anti-Semitism of the right or the anti-Semitism of the left is a bigger problem. And, mm-hmm. you know, there is – I recently wrote an article against the weaponization of anti-Semitism on these lines, and was surprised at how many people wrote to me saying – I'm glad you wrote that article, but you must understand that the anti-Semitism of the movement that I'm against is much bigger problem than the anti-Semitism of the movement that I'm part of. And I got those emails often with in very angry terms, sometimes in gentler terms, from people of both the left and the right. And I, you know, even people like, you know, Barry Weiss recently wrote a book that, you know, basically argues that the anti-Semitism of the left is a bigger problem, notwithstanding the sort of spectacular violence of some of the white nationalist attacks. Do you think that is just a feature of the polarization of the of our politics at this time, or and both within the polarization within the Jewish community, but also the polarization of the larger society, or is there a real argument to be had there that, hey, maybe your premise is wrong, though I find it correct, that in fact anti-Semitism isn't anti-Semitism. There is a distinct left and right anti-Semitism. They produce different pathologies, and you can compare those pathologies.
It's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. I think it's a very academic question. To me, when we're thinking about, well, how do you solve it? How do you stop it? To me, like for right now, the most pressing issue is this, you know, the violence against Orthodox Jews. And there's no, that I still believe is non-ideological. So to me, that this question of which one is worse, like that's why nobody can talk about the Orthodox Jewish, the violence against Orthodox Jews, is because it doesn't fall into either of the categories. So it's kind of everybody just sort of throws up their hands and says, oh, it's not this, it's not that. And that, it's so funny because, you know, at this rally where 25,000 Jews showed up to march on behalf of Orthodox Jews, you know, the speeches were, they were ridiculous. They were about BDS and anti-Semitism on college campuses. It's like, what does that have to do with what's going on in Brooklyn? Nothing. Like, really nothing. Even when Jews get together to try to help Orthodox Jews, they end up talking about their own favorite bugbears instead of actually addressing the issue at hand. So, you know, I'm sure that there is an academic conversation to be had about left versus right, but to me, it really does miss the mark because, it, you know, who says like a grammar? So yeah, of course you have like the dialect of this kind of dialect and that kind of dialect, but the same, at the end of the day, they're speaking the same language, and our brothers and sisters are being bashed up in the streets of the most liberal city in, you know, in America. So what does it amount to at the end of the day?
All right. So let's, so we're Lawfare. So at the end of the day, we talk about security threats. So having set this up, let's talk about this as a security threat. This is one of the hardest security problems around, which is it's highly distributed violence. It does not seem to be organized. The Orthodox community in New York has a pretty large attack surface. People are out walking. They're quite visible, right? They live in relatively discreet neighborhoods. And so my question is, what is not being done on behalf of the security of this community that needs to be done, and who needs to take responsibility for it?
It's a great question. So one of the proposals after, you know, after Hanukkah, de Blasio finally found his voice after about 6 months of this. And they started talking about bringing a heightened police presence into these neighborhoods. Now, of course, it's very tricky because these are neighborhoods that, you know, were very over-policed under stop and frisk. And we know exactly where that goes. There's still a huge problem of police brutality against minority communities. So what do you do with that? And all of the Orthodox leaders that I am in touch with on the regular, they're sensitive to that. I mean, they too feel that that is a problem that they are not blind to. And, you know, what a lot of them said to me was, look, we're anxious for any solution. Is this the perfect one? No, but people are just desperate to hear something. I think to me, somebody said to me recently really resonated, which was that this is really like most of this is extreme forms of bullying, actually. You know, every attack is not a machete attack, is not a shooting rampage. Most of it is kind of like low grade violence, slapping, punching, you know, throwing your hat off. It's bullying, really. And the thing that helps with bullying is for influencers to stand up and say, this is not cool, right? Like, that's kind of the way that you do it, is the people who have influence in these communities among these young kids, that they would stand up and say, this is not cool. This is not how we treat people. That there has been a very big lack of that. I have not seen a lot of people standing up on the regular from within the communities and saying this is not acceptable. So I think that would help a lot. I think the mental health issue is a much deeper issue. You know, it's a problem of anti-Jewish violence, right? These mentally ill people are not attacking the white gentrifiers, which is how you know it's not about gentrification, right? They're attacking from Jews. So but still, they're getting a message that these are the people that you attack when you want to attack someone, which is a problem. But at the same time, the mental health treatment is really problematic right now. So Grafton Thomas, the machete attacker, his family member said, you know, like, he would go and see the doctor and then they would just send him home with pills. And there was no real supervision. There was no real sense of like, well, what do we do with him? You know, how do we continue to help him and at a deeper level? So I think that the New York City should really be re-examining the way that it thinks about mental health and mental health interventions. And then we ran, we did an investigative piece that found that Crown Heights specifically has a much higher share of homeless shelters. Of course, homelessness and mental illness are correlated. It has about double the number of homeless individuals and homeless shelters than the rest of the city. So I don't know what could be done about that right now, but of course, if you're going to be concentrating mentally ill people in a specific neighborhood and it's having this kind of effect, and of course they get concentrated there because of NIMBYism in the sort of in the more wealthy neighborhoods, you know, in Brooklyn, like, that's another problem that I think could be quite easily solved.
So what is, as you have watched this crescendo of attacks over the last 18 months, and particularly the acceleration during and after the attacks over in December, what is the good news? I mean, there's obviously, eventually was this kind of outpouring of community reaction after the machete attack. But I mean, is anything going right in this process, or is this really a larger process of people turning their backs?
I know that a lot of people from the Orthodox community felt a huge relief after the machete attack in Muncie, where suddenly, finally, people were speaking up. I think in terms of like a larger good news, De Blasio did have a good idea, which was to create these kind of mini councils made up of leaders from the Jewish and the Black communities. And I think there is sort of a heightened awareness about the need for, you know, better relations. And I do kind of resist this other narrative that has come up, which is that sort of that places the onus on the Orthodox community to sort of stand up for racial justice or economic justice. Yeah, I personally, like, those are two of the top issues, you know, in my mind. I care a lot about those issues, but the idea that in order to not have your kid get beaten up on the way home from school, you have to make another community's problems your priority seems to me wrong and unfair and unjust, and we would never demand that of another community that was going through something like this. We see that a lot, like this sort of, you know, it's the extension of the gentrification explanation, where there's sort of deep-seated injustices plaguing the African-American communities where these attacks are happening, and that, you know, that is how you solve this, you know. And even though I do want to see those injustices solved, at the same time, I feel that tying them together to this, to these attacks, number one, unfairly puts the onus on the Hasidic community, and number two, unfairly maligns the Black community in its entirety as though it supports these attacks, because of course they must, you know, feel the injustices, so that thus they support these acts. No, of course not. It's not the Black community in its entirety. It's not being condoned, although I do wish that there was more of an outcry.
So this has been latent in the entire conversation, but I mean, are there generally high tensions between Black communities and Hasidic communities in New York these days? I know there was a period in the 90s where the tensions in Crown Heights in particular were quite elevated because of a combination of a car accident and and a killing of a Hasidic man in response. But I have not had the impression, apart from these attacks, which, as you say, are not really the community. They're just people, often mentally ill people within the community. I have not generally had the impression that this was a period of particularly high Black-Jewish tensions in New York. Is that wrong?
You know, it's interesting how you phrase it. So my sense also is that it is not a time of high tensions. It is a time in which Orthodox Jews are terrified. But that has not sort of resulted in, tension, I guess, suggests that it goes two ways. And I don't think that there is, that is not, I agree with you. My impression has been, and also the impression I'm getting from leaders and from people I've spoken to, is that it does not feel like, you know, things are, you know, about to combust or whatever it is. But at the same time, Orthodox Jews are very, very afraid right now. And of course, they don't feel that they have the choice to not wear a yarmulke, to not wear a wig, to not, you know, that's their religion. It's not a choice for them. And so they feel very much under threat. At the same time, there is also a spiritual element to it, because religious people often will sublimate what's happening to them into a more religious register. And there is a sense as well of, especially, you know, in Satmar community, for example, which is a very Hasidic sect that lives in Williamsburg, the sense of like, well, of course, this is what it is to be a Jew. You know, like, what did you expect? Like, it wasn't going to go away. Like, there's very much a sense that like, well, this is our heritage, is to suffer in this particular way. And if I, you know, I've asked a few of those leaders, like, well, so does your community see this as anti-Semitic? They'll say, no, it's teenagers blowing off steam, you know, that's what they do. So they would resist like putting it in anti-Semitic terms. But I think the word tension is wrong, but the Jewish community is quite afraid.
So when you zoom out and look at the aggregate environment in which in the last 2 years, we have had major white supremacist violence against Jewish targets, we've had an upswing of much lower grade vandalisms and kind of, you know, swastika paintings, and in which, I mean, I've just at a personal level, the percentage of my emails that are, you know, overtly anti-Semitic has gone through the roof over the last few years. I don't mention that to put myself in the middle of this by any means, but just as an example of what is happening in the intellectual climate, the number of people who are kind of daily subject to, you know, sort of overt, absurd anti-Semitism on Twitter, by email, or just in their actual snail mail is really changed. And you have in the New York area this real, quite intense wave of violent attacks that range, as you describe it, from bullying to quite lethal gun and machete attacks. What should we make of the whole picture?
You know, Shvera Yitzhak, right? It's tough to be a Jew. No, I mean, the most compelling theory is that, you know, we're living in a conspiratorial time. The president is a conspiracy theorist, and the ripple effects of his penchant for conspiratorial thinking and racist language, the ripple effects are not only within his own party, but in the way that a lot of people have chosen to respond to him. And that it's going to take a long time to unlearn that sort of knee-jerk, oh, well, who is behind this? You know what I mean? That's kind of the distrust with the media that's, you know, on the right and on the left, like all of this stuff, this way that we have now of being, of seeing this kind of, you know, big, bad, evil behind everything, hiding behind every corner. It's a conspiratorial moment, and we're all kind of participating in it, and it feeds so easily into the conspiracy theory that is anti-Semitism. And like you say, you see it popping up in all these different ways. I guess that would be my kind of summary of it.
Batya Ongar Sargon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this week was Michaela Fogel. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music, as ever, is performed by Sophia Yan. Our merch is available, as it always is, at thelawfarestore.com. You, as you always should promote the Lawfare podcast on social media, and you should leave us a review and a rating on whatever podcast distribution service you found us on. And as always, we thank you oh so very much for listening.